Good afternoon. I'm Greg Daniel, Fellow and Managing Director at the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform. I'd like to thank all of you for joining us today for our continuing series of roundtable discussions on active medical product surveillance. One of the key challenges in conducting active surveillance is determining the most appropriate methodological approaches that are suitable for each type of monitoring activity, and we're going to hear a lot about that today. We'll be discussing how researchers within the MiniSentinel pilot project have overcome this challenge by developing a classification system for better understanding when to use what type of methodological approach depending on the types and characteristics of the medical product and the possible adverse event that they're trying to evaluate. So as we know, MiniSentinel, typically the MiniSentinel evaluations are described as being signal refinement activities that seek to better understand the clinical significance of suspected associations between drugs and possible adverse events. And the issue is that there are a variety of characteristics about the medical products and about the possible adverse events that make the situation of not one particular method is best suited for every single medical product adverse event evaluation. So in an effort to provide clearer and more practical guidance for methodology selection, the researchers have developed the structured decision approach to provide the most guidance towards the most appropriate methods for signal refinement activities. These decision tables that you'll see a lot about today are able to categorize medical product safety scenarios according to key characteristics of each product and outcome pair. Our first presenter will talk about that particular taxonomy of surveillance methods. Our second presenter will discuss methods framework for specifically as they relate to vaccines in the vaccine safety monitoring within the post-licensure rapid immunization safety monitoring program, which is PRISM. Many of you may have already heard about that. And then after those two presentations, towards the end of today's webinar, we'll have a period of time for questions from the audience. Before we begin those presentations, I want to cover a few housekeeping activities. As I indicated, we encourage all of you to please present questions as you hear throughout the two presentations today. You can submit your questions by using the Q&A tab at the top of your screen. If you type in your questions, the folks at Brookings will be able to read your questions. At the end of the presentations, so we'll go ahead and have both presentations first. At the end of those, if you submitted questions, we'll call on you in the order that you submitted your question and ask that you read your question to the presenters. Just as a reminder, please make sure that the microphone on your telephone is muted by either pressing the mute button or *6. But towards the end of the presentation, if you want to ask your question, in order to unmute your phone, you'll need to press *7. If you experience any technical questions throughout the presentation, please call the Level 3 conferencing at 1-888-447-1119. So today I'd like to present the two presenters. First, we'll have Josh Gagne, who is a researcher and instructor in medicine at the Division of Pharmacoepidemiology and Pharmacoeconomics, Department of Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Josh is also the workgroup leader on the MiniSentinel Taxonomy Workgroup. The second presenter is Megan Baker. Megan is with the Department of Population Medicine at Harvard Medical School, but she's within the Division of Infectious Diseases at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Institute. Again, as I indicated, after the presentations, my colleague at Brookings, who is Joel Wu, will open the lines for questions. Please remember that you can submit your questions at any time using the Q&A tab throughout the presentations, and he'll call on you at the end. I now like to hand things over to Josh and Megan. Josh, are you on the line?
I am, Greg. Can you hear me?
I can. Thank you.
Great. So thanks, Greg, for the introduction, and thanks to you and to Brookings for hosting this roundtable, and, of course, thanks to FDA for funding this, what I think is an important project, and also thanks to everyone who logged on today. I have the privilege today to describe some of the ongoing work in this taxonomy project that's been the product of many people's effort. And I want to spend the first few seconds providing a kind of taxonomy in a nutshell overview of the project. So in any medical product safety analysis, many methodological decisions must be made, as Greg mentioned, and the decision-making process can be quite time-intensive. The taxonomy project really attempts to characterize this decision-making process by identifying what the decision points are, what the options are at each decision node, and what factors influence decisions among the options. Ultimately, we hope that this framework will facilitate decision-making in a routine active surveillance context when time is of the essence. So with that, over the next 20 minutes or so, I want to provide a bit more detail on why the taxonomy project exists, why it's important to MiniSentinel, and I'll do this by describing the objectives of the work group. Then we'll delve into some of the technical aspects of the work as we cover scenario characteristics and how these impact on decision points and methods options. Then we'll talk about an example, kind of pulling this together in hopefully a more tangible and cohesive way for everyone. And then finally, we'll conclude with some of the most current ongoing work and where the project is going in the future. So as you know, a Sentinel-like system has the potential to perform many functions that are not possible with existing passive surveillance systems. At a basic level, an active monitoring system can describe the patients who use a particular medical product, as well as those patients' concomitant exposures. But possibly the most important feature is that such a system has the capacity to perform active surveillance to assess whether medical products increase occurrence of adverse events. Within the scope of active surveillance, FDA defines three phases of safety monitoring, which they call signal generation, signal refinement, and signal evaluation. The taxonomy project focuses on signal refinement, and specifically the epidemiological and statistical methods to conduct signal refinement. FDA defines signal refinement as an epidemiological process for evaluating the magnitude and clinical significance of suspected associations. And in my mind, at least, this process follows the general framework of any surveillance system in which there's some input, in this case, longitudinal electronic healthcare data, some machine, in this case, methods for signal refinement, and then some output, in this case, effect estimates and certainty around them in the form of alerts. So given the potential consequences for all stakeholders of both false positive and false negative alerts, getting the analytic methods right is essential. And the right analytic methods really live at the center of the system. And by applying the right analytic methods in the right scenarios, we can minimize false positives and false negatives at the outset. So as you know, and as Greg alluded to, there are many design and analytic methods that are available for signal refinement in active medical product safety surveillance. And as with any scientific method, each requires certain assumptions that may hold or approximately hold in some scenarios, but not in others. And so just as a side note, I want to clarify what I mean by scenario. I'll be using this term quite frequently. So I define a scenario as a single exposure outcome pair, for example, a diabetes drug and heart attack. As each method requires certain assumptions and different assumptions are met in different scenarios, it's only logical that no single method will perform well in all cases. So if we can preemptively determine which methods will likely be the most appropriate for given kinds of scenarios, then we can approach a methodological decision-making process that is collaborative, standardized, transparent, and timely. Okay, so with that, the objectives of the taxonomy work group have been first, to identify the characteristics of representative scenarios that have implications for methodological decisions, to characterize the methods suitable for signal refinement in a Sentinel-like system, keeping in mind the constraints of conducting routine active safety surveillance within a network of distributed electronic healthcare databases, and to map the scenario characteristics to the analytic methods via structured decision table to provide clarity and practical advice for methodological decision-making for signal refinement. As you can probably guess, the emerging framework very much mirrors the decision-making process investigators go through when designing and conducting a medical product safety study. And now, actually, the most current work, we're evaluating the framework using a large number of example scenarios, and we're working on developing an interface and implementation guide to facilitate the use of this framework. So here's a very basic visual kind of depicting how we've approached this task. We decided that there are four general classes of scenario characteristics that bear on the most appropriate methods for signal refinement. These are characteristics defined by the stakeholder, exposure characteristics, outcome characteristics, and then characteristics of a possible link between exposure and outcome. But the basic idea here is that different combinations of these characteristics lend themselves better to some design and analytic methods than others. And we'll start with the scenario characteristics, and then we'll move on to some of the methodological options, and then tie them together by way of an example. So the first step in really any medical product safety assessment is asking the question, what is the question? Asking, is a medical product associated with an outcome really isn't a precise scientific question. So we need to be able to further refine that. So just as an illustration, consider the following question. It's not about a medical product per se, but I think it nicely illustrates the point. So is exercise associated with heart attack? That's a scientific question, but it's not a well-defined scientific question because over time, exercise is believed to reduce cardiovascular risk. But in the short term, intense exercise can trigger heart attacks. So we need to be very specific about what we're trying to evaluate. And the intent of the scenario characteristics, specifically that the stakeholders define at the outset, is to refine the question of interest to ensure that the methods one chooses answers the real question of interest. Any method can give you essentially an answer, but different methods answer different questions. And sometimes these questions differ in subtle ways, but with not so subtle implications. So by specifying the effect measure of interest, the comparison group of groups, these characteristics can help frame a more precise scientific question. So then what are the characteristics that are inherent to a particular scenario? And so we define these as exposure, health outcome of interest, and then the link between these. In any scenario, there are a number of different factors that could influence what methods we expect to perform well. So for example, with respect to exposure, the background frequency of use in a population can affect the performance of certain confounding adjustment techniques, for example. So as one example, propensity scores generally don't perform well when we don't have a lot of exposed patients. There are other exposure characteristics, such as the time trend in utilization of the medical product and the general use pattern, such as whether the product is intended for short-term or long-term use, that can also affect methods choices. For outcomes, the background frequency and expected degree of onset misclassification are key drivers of methodological decisions. And what I mean by degree of onset misclassification is how well we can date the incidence of an outcome in electronic healthcare data. And then finally, there are characteristics that can't be neatly classified as being specific to the exposure or to the outcome because they relate to both. And so, for example, if we consider the exposure risk window, which is the interval over which a medical product confers a certain risk, in some case following an induction period, we need to be mindful both of the onset of the interval and the interval duration. Confounding also involves both exposure and outcome and can actually manifest on multiple dimensions. So, for example, confounding can occur between people in which two populations differ with respect to the risk of the outcome of interest. It can also manifest on a within-person basis or so-called time-varying confounding when patients' underlying risk of an outcome changes over time, such as when medical conditions wax and wane. So these are what we've determined to be the most important factors related to the scenario of interest that drive methodological decision-making in routine active surveillance. And the two taxonomy reports are available on the MiniSentinel webpage, and they go into a lot more detail about why these factors, but not others, were determined to be the most important. So I'd refer you to there for more detail than I'm able to cover here today. Okay, so I'd like to think of the taxonomy project really as two taxonomies, one to categorize the scenario characteristics, as I just described, and then the second to classify methods according to key decision points that one would consider in a signal refinement activity. Once we've refined our scientific question and given that specific question of interest, we must decide what is the most appropriate contrast. That is, from where do we draw our expected and observed counts or rates? So depending on the contrast, one might next decide how to address so once we decide on the contrast, the next issue really is to decide on whether we need to think about time trend bias in certain types of analyses, and I'll describe what that means in just a moment. And then other key decision points along this process include methods to address confounding. And confounding really is one of the key aspects of what we've thought about in this taxonomy project because I think confounding is likely to be the biggest threat to both false positive and false negative alerting in a Sentinel-like system where we're relying on observational data that are captured in kind of routine care settings. And then finally, we've got to think about how we'll estimate or perform the estimation procedure. And we'll drill down into each of these in just a little bit. So really, every epidemiologic analysis boils down to contrasting some observed count or rate to some expected count or rate, right? So the observed figures will, of course, come from the cohort of patients who are exposed to the medical product of interest. Then the fundamental design choice for signal refinement is whether expected figures should be drawn from the same cohort of patients or from a separate population. And we refer to these as within-person or between-person contrasts. And together, they really encapsulate all of the different epidemiologic designs that we can think of. But importantly, each approach requires different assumptions. So, for example, the within-person comparison assumes an absence of within-person time-variant confounding, and between-person comparisons assumes that outcome risk between populations is the same or can be made approximately so with analytic methods. The assumptions of within-person comparisons are really most tenable when the exposure of interest occurs independent of a patient's underlying biologic processes, and the outcome of interest is presumed to occur shortly after the exposure, such as with many childhood vaccine exposures. And Megan will talk in more detail about that in particular. The assumptions of a between-person comparison, on the other hand, so it's kind of classical cohort design, are most tenable when an active comparator exists such that the determinants of exposure to the comparator are the same as those for the exposure of interest, and thus minimize confounding. So if we decide to select a within-person or so-called self-control approach, the next consideration is whether a background time trend in exposure exists that could bias the results. So, for example, in traditional case crossover analyses, which systematically order referent periods before case periods, they can be biased when uptake of a drug is increasing, such as in a drug's early marketing period, which is a time during which mini sentinel will be very interested, so kind of when new drugs come onto the market. And there are various options that exist to address the potential time trend biases, and each of these has its own inherent assumptions. And I won't go into those specifically here, but I'm happy to discuss them later on in the roundtable if you're interested. So if we consider then a between-person comparison, the most important source of bias is confounding, likely. And confounder summary scores, such as propensity scores and disease risk scores, offer a particularly attractive option for addressing confounding in these settings when we're thinking about doing analyses across a distributed network of databases. And so the different confounder summary scores can be advantageous in different situations. For example, propensity scores can be good when there are few outcome events or multiple outcomes and plenty of exposed and unexposed patients or patients exposed to each of the different medical products of interest. And then disease risk scores can be useful when maybe there are few exposed patients or when there are multiple exposure levels, but we're interested in evaluating a single outcome. Of course, regardless of whether summary scores are used, one must also decide how to address confounding in the estimation procedure. And the four most common options are listed here, and those are stratification, matching, modeling, or weighting. And again, each of these carries certain assumptions. There are also considerations for selecting among these that go beyond the scenario characteristics that I've defined, such as to which population the estimate applies. And then finally, each estimation procedure to arrive at a point estimate in its variance also requires assumptions. And we've broadly classified these as having no outcome model, generalized linear models such as logistic or Poisson regression, and then survival models such as the commonly used Cox proportional hazards model. All right. So if you found all that a bit abstract, no worries. I think that's actually exactly why we need this taxonomy framework, is because there's a lot of nuance to methodological decision-making and a lot of decisions that need to be made when setting up any given monitoring activity. So hopefully this example will help kind of bring it together a bit. Imagine that a new statin comes on the market, and we're interested in understanding whether the rate of occurrence of rhabdomyolysis following exposure to this new statin is higher or the same as the rate of rhabdo among patients treated with other statins. And here, for this example, I'm using rosuvastatin, which, of course, is not a new drug, but let's imagine that it were. So let's assume that we want to know how the rates compare on both the absolute difference and ratio scale. So we define our scenario characteristics up here as both difference and ratio measures, and we're comparing to a group of patients who initiate treatment on other statins. So in this context, we classify use of rosuvastatin as a fairly common exposure. That is, it's not a rarely used drug since it's used for a fairly common condition or indication. And the drug is intended to be used long-term. And again, so if we were in the setting of a newly marketed drug, we'd assume that the use of rosuvastatin would be increasing as it's taken up in the marketplace. Skipping down here to the outcomes, the outcome of interest, rhabdomyolysis, is rare. We'd probably be interested only in its incidence or first outcome, and when full-blown rhabdo comes on, it's actually fairly acute. So based on what we know about the pharmacology and biology of this particular example, we'd then want to consider what the risk window would be, and probably would determine that it could happen or it could begin shortly after initiation of the statin and last potentially for a long time. So we'd say that the onset could be immediate and the duration long. But because rhabdo is a fairly unpredictable event, within-person confounding is likely not strong. And also, if we compare statins, so we compare using an active comparator, which comprises all other statins, there's probably not a lot of confounding with respect to the rhabdomyolysis outcome in this example. And, of course, confounding is outcome-dependent, so there could be more confounding if we looked at a different outcome. So now that all the different characteristics are defined for this particular example, we have a structured decision table which codifies all these different characteristics and helps guide us through the decision-making process to provide some recommendation about which approach, based on the different assumptions, would likely be most useful. And so this is really just an excerpt of the much larger table. But the basic idea is that after we've agreed on all the scenario characteristics, we can map that specific combination of characteristics to a particular combination of appropriate methods or set of methods. So if we chart the characteristics of rosuvastatin and rhabdo, for example, and follow this all the way out, we'd arrive at this recommendation here at the bottom that that the most appropriate approach, based on the assumptions inherent in a particular combination of scenario characteristics, is that we'd consider a cohort design with or without confounder summarization via propensity score, and then using it as an estimation procedure that's a time-to-event model. So to summarize, there are many methods that can be used for signal refinement in the routine medical product safety context, but we expect certain methods to perform better in certain scenarios based on the extent to which the assumptions of the methods hold, given the characteristics of the scenarios. Of course, there are many additional factors and clinical and epidemiologic nuance that must be considered, but I think this framework provides a good general guidance on how to approach a wide spectrum of potential monitoring scenarios. And we've actually found that a few combinations of methods can cover the majority of routine surveillance activities. Nevertheless, I think there's still a need for more nuanced taxonomies for specific product types beyond this general framework, and Megan will actually talk about a more specific taxonomy for vaccines in just a moment. In terms of future, there are three combinations of methods that we think will cover a large majority of routine surveillance activities, and these are currently being operationalized into modular programs that will be available to MiniSentinel as part of another work group. And so based on the current work in the taxonomy project, we think that these three modules, a self-control module and then two different cohort approaches, will covered most of the different types of active surveillance activities that that MiniSentinel might at least initially be interested in. And then in terms of future within the taxonomy project itself, we're working to test and improve the utility and practicability of the framework by evaluating it in a large sample of exposure outcome pairs that are relevant to FDA. And this framework is very much a living or working framework, and we're looking to refine it as new methods are developed and as we learn more and more about the performance of methods in a signal refinement context. We also intend that this evaluation that we're conducting now with this large sample of exposure outcome pairs will help elucidate the next top priorities for modular methods development. And, of course, last but by no means least, I want to acknowledge that many folks have contributed in many important ways to this project. In fact, there are many more people beyond those that I list on this slide that have contributed in other ways to the project, and they're all listed in the two taxonomy reports. But that concludes my portion of the discussion. So now I will turn it over to Megan.
Great. Thanks, Josh. Megan, are you there? Megan, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Please go ahead.
Excellent. Well, good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity to speak about the methods framework for vaccine safety monitoring and the post-licensure rapid immunization safety monitoring component of the mini-sentinel. And I'm presenting on behalf of the methods framework work group. So PRISM, which stands for Post-Licensure Rapid Immunization Safety Monitoring, was initiated in 2009 by the Department of Health and Human Services in response to the need to monitor the safety of H1N1 influenza vaccine. And then in 2010, PRISM became the immunization safety monitoring component of FDA's mini-sentinel project, which is the program to actively monitor on the safety of medical products using electronic health information. And as you know, mini-sentinel uses a distributed data network that allows data partners to create data files in a standard format and to maintain possession of those files. And the data partners perform most analyses of their data by running computer programs distributed by the mini-sentinel operations center. So PRISM currently has the largest cohort in the U.S. general population for active vaccine safety surveillance. It includes claims data from 4 national health insurers and vaccine data from 8 immunization registries. And the database includes 107 million individuals and 318 million person years of observation time from 2004 to 2012. And in 2011, 50 million individuals were enrolled in accumulating new data, and 32 million of those individuals had more than 3 years of data available. The population included in PRISM activities is distinguished by the size and geographic diversity, which facilitates evaluations of rare adverse events. And in addition to the vaccine claims data, the data partners link to immunization registries, which allow for more complete vaccine exposure data, particularly for vaccines given in locations other than the primary healthcare office where claims-based data may be missing. So the methods framework focused on the methodological approaches to vaccine safety monitoring within the mini-sentinel system, particularly centering on vaccine study designs appropriate for signal refinement, a component of active surveillance that occurs after a potential association between a vaccine and a health outcome has been identified. And this may occur either during product development, after marketing, or based on a scientific hypothesis. And these methodological considerations are not limited to signal refinement, however, and they can be extended then to signal evaluation, focusing on further epidemiological exploration of a potential causal relationship. The methods framework that I'm presenting today seeks to provide a description of observational study designs commonly used to evaluate the association between vaccine and a vaccine exposure and adverse events. And in addition, we provide a structured decision table to aid in planning of future PRISM studies. So the choice of studies design for exploring a potential association will depend on the vaccine exposure, health outcome of interest, strength of the association, the time variant and time stable confounding with or without potentially effect modification, and the characteristics of the database available. Vaccine exposures are different than many drug exposures in that they are instant, often well documented if they're given in the office center, although exposure misclassification can occur if vaccines are being received in settings other than a clinical office, including, for example, a community center, a pharmacy, or at the workplace. And in these cases, documentation may not be available in the patient record or claims data. Other potential sources of exposure misclassification might include documentation errors in the medical records and state registries or delays in claims. And a few other considerations for vaccine exposures include the fact that other vaccines are commonly given simultaneously. And finally, many vaccines are given across the population, and finding a control population may be challenging. The choice of the study design also relies on the health outcomes and includes whether they are rare or common, the consideration of the risk window if it is short or delayed, and the onset of the outcome, which may be well-defined or insidious. The risk window, which is the post-vaccination period monitored for the health outcome of interest, is of great importance, and this estimation of the timing and the duration of this window may prevent accurate classification of a health outcome of interest. A variety of study designs to evaluate vaccine safety have been developed, and each design has strengths and limitations in its ability to account for the number of problems that can threaten the validity of vaccine safety studies, which might include selection bias, time-stable confounders, confounding due to age and season and other time-dependent factors, and variation across a region or health plans. Effect modification, characteristics of the database, and the potential strength of the association being evaluated are also considerations. A list of study designs which may be useful in vaccine safety evaluations are listed on this slide. This is not exhaustive, and additional study designs or variations on these study designs are also used. And I'll briefly review the cohorts for these study designs. So the unit of observation and ecologic study is the population rather than the individual. Therefore, vaccination rates and vaccine coverage are properties of the population and distributions of risk factors, vaccination rates, and the outcome of interest are obtained for each population. In the cohort study, then, vaccinated and unvaccinated persons or persons vaccinated with a different vaccine are followed for a period of time, and the incidence of the health outcome of interest in the two groups are compared. The control group may be a historical comparison group or a concurrent group. In the case control study, vaccination status is compared between subjects who experience a health outcome of interest in a control group chosen from the population that gave rise to the cases who do not experience the adverse event. In the risk interval design, vaccinated individuals comprise the study population and incidences of health outcome during risk and non-risk periods are compared, and a pre-specified time period after vaccination is considered the risk interval, and participants with events during this period are considered exposed cases. Unexposed cases are those vaccinated during the study period and with events which occur during the time periods outside the risk interval. In the self-controlled risk interval design, vaccinated individuals comprise the study population. Each vaccinated individual contributes exposed and unexposed person time, and the exposed and unexposed person times of the same person are self-matched. And this design compares the risk of an adverse event in the risk interval versus the unexposed interval while adjusting for within-subject correlation. In the self-controlled case series method, the case crossover analysis and the case-centered analyses, subjects who experience at least one adverse event during a predefined study period are included. And in the case-centered analysis, expectations about whether an adverse event was in a risk window are derived from the case's stratum of the population and surveillance. So the structured decision table may be used as a starting point when considering study designs using data from PRISM or mini-Sentinel. The design options are not exhaustive and do not take into account the many variations within a study design, but rather they include examples which may be considered when planning an evaluation. The first decision point involves the availability of the data, and there's a large amount of data that is easily available in PRISM. Exposure misclassification may or may not be negligible. Vaccines given in vaccine clinics, workplace, and pharmacies are more likely to be missing from PRISM data than vaccines given in the primary clinician offices. The onset and duration of exposure risk interval may be well-defined and short, which lends itself to study designs requiring a well-defined risk window, such as many of the self-controlled designs, or long and insidious, where a design such as a cohort study might be more appropriate. When time-stable factors, such as genetic factors or potential confounding factors, a self-controlled study may be appropriate, where the individual serves as their own control. And when time variant factors such as age or season are potential confounding factors, a case-centered analysis or cohort study may be appropriate. So I would like to focus on an example study, the evaluation of a potential association between a rotavirus vaccine and the health outcome intussusception, which is a serious disorder in which part of the intestine slides into another part of the intestine, similar in a way that a telescope slides into one another. The vaccine is generally given in the primary care clinic. Thus, misclassification is negligible, and the outcome onset is well-defined and short. The time-stable factors are negligible, but time-variant factors are not negligible, as age is a potential confounding factor. And so here you see the structured decision table again, and we can follow it out. And so one might consider then a cohort analysis, a case-centered analysis, or a self-controlled risk interval analysis. So the cohort design was actually used by Shui et al. And JAMA in 2012 to examine the risk of intussusception among U.S. infants following the pentavalent rotavirus vaccine. A large cohort with easily available exposure data and a low rate of loss to follow-up was available to the authors of the study, and limitations of the study included the comparability of the rotavirus-vaccinated infants with infants who did not receive the vaccine, and this is often a challenge when using the cohort design for vaccine-related studies. Another limitation was the potential for residual confounding by age, and time-defending confounding was addressed by stratification in the study. On the other hand, the cohort design is familiar to many researchers, and measured confounders are easily adjusted for in the statistical analysis. The self-controlled risk interval design is another choice and is described in the PRISM protocol for monitoring for intussusception after rotavirus vaccine in PRISM. And the benefit of this study design is that it controls for time-stable confounders. However, the method does not intrinsically control for time-variant confounding factors. Vaccinated individuals comprise the study population, and each vaccinated individual contributes exposed and unexposed person time. The exposed and unexposed person time of the same person are self-matched, and this design compares the risk of an adverse event in the risk interval versus the unexposed interval, while it adjusts for within-subject correlation. Each individual contributes one or more unexposed interval before the exposure and or after the exposure. And compared to the self-controlled K-series method that you see on the right, the self-controlled risk interval design may be less susceptible to bias due to time-varying confounding as the follow-up period is usually shorter. All vaccinated individuals are included in the study as opposed to in the self-controlled K-series design, where the study base is restricted to cases. And finally, in the standard K-series design, unexposed time may occur before and or after vaccination, and this may or may not be the case in a self-controlled risk interval design. In the case crossover design, the cohort is comprised of only cases, and the study design is based on the self-controlled design. The benefits of the design choice are similar to those of the self-controlled K-series design, including control of static confounders by the self-controlled design and minimization of the risk of misclassification of vaccine exposure if only vaccinated cases are included in the study design. The design choice is susceptible, though, to time-varying confounding, and traditionally the case crossover design is unidirectional, unlike the self-controlled K-series design, and the subjects are censored at the outcome, limited observation time, but at the same time potentially reducing the bias due to reverse causality. The case-centered design, which you see on the right, is also described in the PRISM rotavirus protocol. The case-centered design can be used to examine whether more health outcomes occur during a risk window than would be expected if there was no increased risk due to the vaccine. Expectations about the health outcome are derived from the case's stratum of the population in surveillance, and the results then include an estimate of the odds ratio and corresponding tests of whether risk is elevated during the risk window. The case-centered approach can be especially useful for PRISM safety surveillance because it focuses on the exposed cases whose experience is most influential in answering the research question, and it adjusts carefully for age or seasonality and for other confounders that characterize everybody in the stratum or risk set on the day of the outcome event. So we have broken the structured decision table down into various components, and I've circled the three examples that might be used when evaluating rotavirus vaccine and health outcome intussusception. First, we can consider the data requirement for PRISM, and I had mentioned that there's a large amount of data available. The next component is the potential for exposure misclassification bias, and in the case of rotavirus vaccine, this is less important as the vaccine is often given in the primary care health setting. Next question is the outcome later with an insidious onset? If this were true, we might consider avoiding the self-controlled risk, the self-controlled design and focusing on the cohort or case control design. And then the self-controlled designs implicitly control for time-stable factors. Finally, the case-centered approach controls well for time-variant factors. The other studies permit control for time-variant factors, but the offset term in the case-centered design is unique. So strengths of the PRISM program include the large, diverse general population, the ability to capture vaccine data from claims as well as immunization registries, and the potential to conduct vaccine safety surveillance efficiently and the power to detect rare outcomes considering the large population. Current efforts in both PRISM and MiniCentral include data mining to address signal detection, data management, and sequential statistical analyses to give PRISM the capacity to evaluate the freshest data possible for surveillance of new vaccines. Also, we're looking into pregnancy surveillance development, confounder adjustment, and analysis strategies in a distributed data setting. This PRISM is currently well-positioned to evaluate vaccine safety signals, but also to continue developing methods to efficiently perform vaccine safety surveillance using a claims-based system. So the work presented here is really a joint effort by so many people. First of all, the PRISM Methods Framework Work Group, which includes Tracy Liu, Michael Nguyen, Wei Hua, and Yandong Chiang, and many, many others who are listed here who have contributed to this work.
Great. Thank you for your presentation, Megan. I think we'll move directly to the questions that people have. If you have any questions, please submit them, and we'll get to the people in the order that they were submitted. Currently, we don't have any questions at the moment. We did have one earlier, but I guess it was removed. So if you have any questions, please post them to the webinar website, and then we'll get to them as soon as we can. So we have one question from Maria. Just as a quick reminder, in order to ask a question, please unmute your line by pressing star 7. Please go ahead with the question. Maria, are you there? I'll read the question for her. Can you please describe immortal time bias? Josh and Megan, are you there? Did you hear the question?
Yeah, I'm here. Megan, I'm guessing that's a question for you since I didn't mention immortal time bias.
Yes, I didn't as well, but I may need to think about that just for a minute.
So I can give a one-sentence canned answer, which is just that immortal time bias is person time, so time during a person's follow-up in which in the way that we've constructed the study, that time is event-free by definition. So, for example, if we require a patient to have two prescription fills, let's say two drug fills, in order to be included in the study, and we start follow-up at the first prescription, the time between the first and second prescription is immortal. That is, the patient couldn't have died during that time because we required them to have a second prescription sort of in the future. So it's time that's event-free by definition and can create biases in actually multiple directions in observational studies.
Great, thanks. The next question is from Sasha Dublin, and I'm not sure that she can unmute herself, so I will read it for her. Does the taxonomy approach deal with misclassification of outcome status itself, as well as timing of onset, e.g. rhabdomyolysis approach?
Yes, thanks, Sasha. That's a good question. And I did read your question that you had up there before, so I'll try to address both if I can. So I think that all methods will perform best when an outcome definition is highly accurate in electronic healthcare data. And for some outcomes, this is really difficult because if we think about a seizure, for example, it will be difficult to capture an electronic healthcare data with a lot of accuracy if it's not reported to a physician at an office visit or leads to hospitalization. Your question specifically about rhabdomyolysis is a good one. What we tend to do with claims data, thinking about how to increase the specificity or outcomes, is to require that patients have a hospitalization associated with that code. So it'll be, for example, for the rhabdomyolysis outcome, a hospitalization for the rhabdo-ICD-9 code. And this tends to enhance the specificity of those codes quite well. And when we think about estimating ratio effect measures, so rate ratios, for example, as long as we have high specificity, we can get unbiased or near unbiased estimates. And so with both method, with sort of any method that would estimate a ratio measure, we would hope to have high specificity. The issue of the timing of misclassification differentially affects between person versus within person comparisons, and so that's why that particular item is one of the factors that helps distinguish between which approach would be most appropriate. But I think the issue of just generally poor accuracy of an outcome definition will affect all methods unless we have high specificity.
Great, thanks. Our next question is from Ted Lustig, followed by Eileen Meng and then S. Campbell. Ted, are you there? Ted, can you unmute? If not, I'll read the question for you. I'll read the question. The Cox models discussed rely upon ranking of all observations. Do you advocate non-distributed data analysis approaches in such settings? Any major concerns for the implementation of non-distributed approaches?
So I'm trying to understand whether non-distributed means non-distributed across the sort of distributed database or whether that is intended to mean something else. So do you advocate non-distributed data analysis approaches in such settings? Yeah, Ted, I'm not sure exactly how to answer this. I'll have to think about it, and I can follow up with you. But that's an interesting question that I'm not sure I'm prepared to answer.
Yeah. This is Megan. Certainly, confounding adjustment can be challenging in the non-distributed or in the distributed data settings. But I will also give that some thought.
Great, thanks. Eileen, are you there? You're next. As a quick reminder, you can unmute your line by pressing star 7. If not, I can also read this question.
Yeah, I just wanted to know if this is available in a publication.
Yes, for the portion that I discussed, we have two reports that are on the MiniSentinel webpage that are publicly available. There's also a report, a publication in Pharmacoepidemiology and Drug Safety that is very closely mirrors the first year's taxonomy report that was published in the MiniSentinel supplement at, about a year ago at the beginning of 2012. But everything that I discussed is available on the MiniSentinel webpage.
Thank you.
And this is Megan. The methods framework is not yet available. We're in the process of publishing it. I'm happy to follow up with anyone afterwards. But it will become publicly available, but it's not at that point.
Great, thank you. Next we have S. Campbell. All right, I'll go ahead and read the question. How is the temporal baseline established, and are the controls for time variance a factor of moving averages for seasonal adjudication?
Could you please repeat that? I think that was probably based on the case-centered design, but could you please repeat the question?
Sure. How is the temporal baseline established, and are the controls for time variance a factor of moving averages for seasonal adjudication?
So I think that this is referring to the case-centered design. Bruce Fireman is one of the people who have come up with this design, but basically it's we use an offset population and then use strata, which may be on the day. So basically you're looking at your vaccinated individuals, and then you have an offset population where you're looking at strata based on however you've defined it, presumably, say, for age, it could be on the day. For season, it could be larger strata.
Great, thank you. At this point, we don't have any other questions, and if no other questions come up in the next couple minutes, I think we'll probably just wrap up this webinar. Are there any other last-minute questions? Please let us know. Well, it looks like we're not getting any other questions. On behalf of everyone here at Brookings, I would like to thank Josh and Megan for their presentations. I'd also like to thank all of you who tuned in for today's webinar. Presentation materials, including audio, will be posted on the Brookings website in the next few days. Megan's vaccine safety monitoring presentation will be posted to the web once the final results have been published. Our next roundtable webinar will highlight the 5th Annual Sentinel Initiative Public Workshop. This public workshop will be held on January 31st, 2013, at the Washington Marriott Wardman Park in Washington, D.C., with a webinar highlighting the day's events following in February. Additional information will be sent out in the coming weeks, so please keep an eye out for that. Thanks again for participating this afternoon, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. Please stand by.